I would now like to introduce our main speaker for the evening, Randy G. from La Mesa. You may now clear the room. Go. God has a sense of humor. My name's Randy. I'm an alcoholic. Yvonne S., our scheduled speaker from Los Angeles, left a voicemail on my phone earlier that when it rolled into my voicemail, didn't leave a missed call with a number, so I couldn't even call her back. She said she was stuck in traffic, real bad traffic, somewhere halfway between Los Angeles and San Diego. Thought she'd make it by the break, so we all were out there looking for someone we've never met before to show up. And I got nominated, so here we go. I got a call from Pat tonight about 6 o'clock, and he wanted to know if I'd be the hugger because he had to rescue another friend of ours in the program who had car trouble, and so I said, sure, I'll do that. And then I got here, and Connie asked me if I'd lead, so I gave the hugger gave the hugger role to Sheila, and then Pat showed up anyway. And now I got suckered into this, so... I went out at the break and talked to God and said, you know, just help me be honest and tell the truth. I love Alcoholics Anonymous. It really saved my life, gave me back my life, and I don't know. It's just for me, been a way of life for quite a while now. I got sober. Well, my last drunk was February 6th of 1989. One more time, you know, went down to the Gray Bar Hilton and had totaled another car. Luckily, I didn't kill myself or anybody else that night. Had a pretty high BAC, and it was nuts, you know. Just 90 miles an hour through a residential area with two black and whites on me, La Mesa's finest, and I really thought I was going to, you know, get home and get in the driveway before they got me. But this big tree got in the way. And I thought I was on my street, but I was actually, I'd misjudged it. I turned left one street too soon and came up over the curb and snapped all four tires off the axle and broadside at this tree. And I was driving my company car, and that went over pretty big. So... one more time in the drunk tank, you know, a place I said I would never go back to after the last time that I was there. And found myself in the back of that car again, handcuffs behind my back, behind the cage, you know, mouthing off to the cops. And, you know, they don't appreciate that. And the deputies down at the county jail, they're never friendly. You know, they don't have any sense of humor, and they just don't want to hear it, you know. I really, bits and pieces of that night are really kind of hazy because during my actual last few hours before I was incarcerated, I was in a blackout. I was coming in and out, and I really didn't remember much, and, you know, the whole trip downtown, you know, bits and pieces. So, but anyway, you know, what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now, you know. I'm from Minneapolis. Good place to grow up. Better place to leave. I like Minnesota. But, you know, the state bird's the mosquito, and it gets real cold there. When you're a kid growing up and you can sled and you can skate and toboggan and you can do all that fun stuff, you know, I loved it until I got to be about 16 and I had to start working. And then I had to drive in it and live in it. And, you know, I was going to college back in St. Cloud. 1977, I had a girlfriend at the time that was going through a divorce. And she was my higher power. And I was just thinking about that tonight. I don't know why. But... God, did we party. I mean, it was just on with that woman. And didn't know a soul out here, and we loaded up everything she owned. I didn't own anything. I was 19. I was just completing my third year of college. And, we packed up the truck, and we moved to San Diego. And we hadn't even been on the road 24 hours, and we flipped the U-Haul in Nebraska. We'd been up all night the night before doing a lot of speed and smoking a lot of weed and drinking a lot of alcohol, and we went out with a bang, and we drove our first 12-hour shift, and we stopped and had lunch. And you know those little, remember those the cocktails to go, the doubles in the little twist-off thing? We had too many of those and smoked a little weed, and I was going to take my first rest, and I was lying down on that bench seat, and when I woke up, I was looking up through the window, and we had slid down the interstate on the side of the truck about 500 feet, and it's a miracle we weren't arrested. Came out and flipped the truck up, and when they put the tow truck winch on a U-Haul and that box truck comes down on all four wheels and you hear everything you own or she owned hitting the floor of that box, it's bad, you know. And we didn't have any windows left in the truck now, and we didn't have air conditioning either, and I don't know. We got somewhere in Colorado, and I went to a hardware store, and I bought some plexi something or other and made these makeshift windows with holes cut slats in them so we could let a little air in. But dumped some oil in that thing, and it ran the next morning. It was amazing. So we really got off to a good start, you know. Go west. But, back to Minnesota, you know, I grew up in a real loving family. I was the oldest of three kids, and had a brother 3 years younger than me, and a sister who was 9 years younger than me, who I loved very much. And leave it to Beaver. I mean, leave it to Beaver. You know, child of the early '60s. I was born in '56. We lived in the burbs, two houses down. This huge 25, 30-acre park with ball diamonds and skating rinks in the winter and all the playground equipment and, you know, the drugstore two blocks down the street and the church around the corner. I'm a Reformed Missouri Synod Lutheran. Grew up in Triune God. I was in church every Sunday. My mom was a Sunday school teacher. She was an altar circle. My dad was an elder. He was on the board of trustees at the church, and, you know, I was a acolyte, and you know, went through the whole confirmation thing, and you know, good boy, and all that sort of stuff, and you know, I didn't ever think, when you're a kid, you know, you don't think up that you're going to wake up one day and look in the mirror and be looking at someone who's just lost themselves, you know, who's just full blown alcoholic, addict, alcoholic, drug addict, alcoholic, because that's what I was, and it wasn't the plan. It wasn't the plan. I was a good student. It came very, very easy to me. Honor society. I was in sports. I was captain of the cross-country team. Very popular in school. Student body president, student council, student advisory commission for the city. All these things, you know. But I had already then, by the time I was 15, I was living the Dr. Jekyll, Mr. Hyde life. You know, I tried to be... I tried to fit in with all the groups, you know, the jocks, the heads. I kind of walked the middle. I was kind of trying to be everything to everyone, you know. I just wanted to fit in. I wanted to be a part of, you know. And at a very young age, I don't know, Mom and Dad used to have card parties, you know, and they drank a lot of beer where I'm from. Ham's beer, Budweiser. And I'd go around during the party and I'd be taking the pull off the beer bottle and isn't that cute and ha ha ha. And my dad would give me a pull off his beer, you know. And so I was doing that when I was 5 or 6. I guess they didn't think much of it, you know. And I can't honestly say if my parents were alcoholics. I don't think my mother is. I think my dad might have been, but he's been gone for a long time now. And it's not, again, we hear it's not for us to say who is or who isn't, you know. But I know there was always alcohol in the house. But I knew that by the time I was 30, I drank more alcohol than my dad ever did when he died when he was 51. And I remember being about 6 years old. And, you know, normal people probably don't have visions or memories like this etched into their brain. But my grandfather, this old German farmer from North Dakota, once a year he would bring this tray out at Christmas, and there were these little shot glasses. They looked like a beer mug, and they had like a little handle on them, and he'd fill them up with fortified, like 20-proof port, you know, or sherry. And I had 42 cousins on the one side of the family, and we couldn't wait until we got old enough to get our little shot of sherry at Christmas. And I would be looking around to see who hadn't drank theirs and who didn't like it so that I could get theirs. You know, 6, 7 years old, already thinking, man, working the plan, you know, working the game. And when I would go to my grandparents' house, I couldn't reach that jug. It was up on a really high shelf, but I'd be fixing on that thing. You know, I'd be looking at it because I knew it was going to be a long time before Grandpa opened the jug one more time. But I started drinking my dad's beer and I started drinking his wine when I was about 11 or 12 years old. And I was thinking about it this morning. I went to a meeting this morning and I was looking at this little plastic 6-ounce juice glass. You know those little 5 or 6-ounce little plastic juice glasses? Well, I used to love to drink the wine out of those little juice glasses. And I found out when I was about 11, 12, 13 years old, I started sneaking that stuff, you know. And I had to watch it because he only had 2 big jugs in the fridge and he liked it, so I had to be careful, you know. And I didn't know about watering it down. I'd never heard about that then, you know. But I would I'd have one and I'd just knock it back, just pound it down, you know. And it felt really good going down. I love the taste of alcohol. I do not understand people who do not like the way alcohol tastes. I loved the way alcohol tastes. And after 19 years, I can get euphoric recall like, you know, there is no tomorrow. Warm gin, a half pint of warm gin, scotch, fuck the ice, I don't care. You know, I just... Ice is nice, but it's not important, you know. And as much as I like drinking good wine, you know, expensive wine, I love MD 2020. I love Mad Dog. You know, give me 20 joints and a hard red box, Marlboro box, a pocket full of Speed, and a bottle of MD, and I'm a happy camper. You know, I can associate with lower companions real fast, you know, no problem. But I started drinking that wine, and I didn't know anything, of course, about, you know, if one's good, two's better, and 10 or 12's not enough. But I was already drinking that way when I was 12, you know. And so, you know, just living life. Junior high, high school, sports, going to the football games on Friday night, getting fucked up, falling out of the bleachers, you know, going to the parties afterwards, you know, just growing up, you know, and alcohol was part of the equation. And pretty much when I was about 15 and I had my first real serious girlfriend, you know, and discovered sex and drugs and alcohol all together at the same time. That was about it for me. I was gone. Nothing else really mattered at that point. That was it for me. I was off to the races, and getting high every morning before I went to school. I had this buddy that he and I had a real passion for getting loaded in the morning before we went to our first class, and that's what we did. And so it kind of went downhill in terms of the manageability of my drug and alcohol use. I started a pattern that would follow me for about, the next, just about 20 years. I got through high school okay, I guess. I had a real problem with authority. But I managed to walk the line and, get through it. I took on the assistant principal. I took on the principal. I took on my teachers. I took on my parents. I mean, it was we were doing battle on a regular basis, but I managed to, graduate with good grades and was one of three people that delivered the commencement speech. And basically mine was like, the FU, all as far as anyone in authority or administration. The students loved it. The principal wasn't too fond of it. I'm sure I didn't, do my parents real proud that night, but I thought I had to make a statement, and, what an idiot. So, the drinking and the drugging had been going on for about 3 years at that point. I was 18. I went off to college, and I got to tell you, I really didn't have a clue when I left home for my freshman year of college. I really didn't. Neither my mom or my dad had gone to higher education, and my dad grew up on a farm. He had an 8th grade education, got his GED in the Army in Korea after he got out of Korea, I guess. And, college was just something my parents didn't talk about. I was not prepared. I had no idea what to expect. But I found out that I was at one of the top-ranked party colleges in the United States. That probably wasn't the best place for me to go for my higher education, And, it was truly like Animal House. My freshman year was something else, it was just a party. And I subsequently didn't do real well academically my freshman year. I managed to maintain like about a 2.5, 3.0 some quarters, but it was, it was nip and tuck, let me tell you, because I never slept, and we just drank and smoked weed and other things around the clock. And so that was my first year of college. I went home that summer, and I was sharing this the other day. When I went home for that first summer between school, between going back my sophomore year, and even in high school, I always had a case of beer on ice, Grain Belt on ice, in the trunk of my 68 Galaxy 500, and I always had a bottle of champagne because you never knew you were going to meet that special girl, I loved speed and I loved pot, and I smoked dope like a chimney, and I was always high. My consciousness was always altered. Any concept of God that I had grown up with as a young man, as a child, and as a teenager was gone. I realize now, years later, after being sober, that it's pretty hard to be spiritually fit or maintain any kind of a spiritual condition when your consciousness is altered. And my consciousness was altered on a daily basis. So that summer I came home, and it was just on for 2.5 to 3 months, and I went back my sophomore year, and it was really bad. And I got back there, and I lived in an upperclassman's on-campus apartment with 8 of the guys who were the worst of the – well, there were 7 other guys, including me, 8 – we were like the worst of the worst. We were on probation all the time. They were threatening to kick us out. It was really bad. That woman just walked in. Is that Yvonne? No, she's not Yvonne. Okay. I was hoping. So I'm committed. So I've been committed, but that's part of my story. But, that fall I went back and it got really bad, really, really fast. And of course, I need to throw in my part-time job that year was working at a liquor store. I thought I had arrived. And I worked at Coburn's Liquor, and I dropped all my classes, and I spent all my time in the ceramic studio. I was a pottery, functional potter, and I love pot, and I like to throw pots, and but I was actually pretty good at it. I was really good at utilitarian functional ceramics, and I learned how to do glaze work and fire the kilns, and that's where I spent all my time. I'd spend 30 hours a week in the ceramic studio, 30 hours a week at Coburn's, and then the rest of the time partying with the guys, you know. We had some good parties. Man, we had some good parties, and it was really great. But I remember my parents coming up there before the end of my first quarter was over, and they came up and they took me out for lunch. And I remember the look on their face when they walked into my apartment. It was a Sunday. And they looked around, and there were bodies on the floor, and the dead soldiers everywhere, and bongs, and, you know, articles of clothing strewn about. And I remember we went out for lunch, and at the time, of course, my brother was much younger. My sister was just a little child. And I remember looking at my dad saying, "You got to get me out of here. I think I'm going to have a nervous breakdown." And I was really, like, I was 19, and I was feeling like I was at the jumping off place, but I didn't know what the jumping off place was. I didn't learn about the jumping off place until I read the book. But I was there. And so I took a quarter off and came home and rented a studio, and I produced a lot of work, and I did a one-man show. And I toned my drinking down a little bit, but I still drank every day, and I still smoked a lot and did other things as well. But it was somewhat manageable, but I never had a day where I didn't drink or use. And I went back to school that spring quarter, and it was a little better, but I still drank and used every day, you know. And then that summer between my sophomore year and my junior year, I went back and I finished my third year. You know, I got to tell you, when I went to college, I've shared this before, I drank and drugged my way right out of college, you know. I would go weeks without going to classes. I would literally forget what classes I had. And that panic would set in. This is real. I'm not making this up. I wouldn't know what my schedule was. And I'd walk in and I'd be like, am I in this class? And I think I've got a paper, and when's our midterm? And, I mean, it was really not good, you know. And I don't know, man. I got out of there with about a 2.2. You know, I was like a 3.8 when I graduated from high school. And it was not going. The plan was not going real well. So going to California sounded like a pretty good idea. And I don't know, man. I got to California in 77 and... like I said, I had $500 in my pocket, and I didn't have a pot to piss in, and I couldn't find a job, and I was really kind of thinking that maybe I'd made the wrong choice. And this girl that I was with, we ended up buying a house, and I worked for this guy who was a real alcoholic, and he really taught me how to drink hard liquor like I'd never drank it before. And this guy liked me, and he would take me out three or four nights a week, and we would drink. And that was my real introduction to, you know, whiskey and bourbon and scotch and mostly CC, Canadian Club on the Rocks. And I had to keep up with them, you know. And and we'd be out until closing, and then I'd have to get up at 6 o'clock and go to work. And, you know, you'd smoke that big fat one in the morning, and by noon you'd be drinking beer, and at 4 o'clock we'd go buy a case, and then we'd buy another case, and that was how my day went. And I stayed in that job for 4.5 years, and I went to work at a car dealership, and I drank and drugged every day of my life on that job for 8 years. And that's when I, you know, had the episode with the car and the La Mesa police, and I'd had a few other DUIs before that, and countless other attempts to go to jail that were unsuccessful. They just got lucky, you know. Meeting I went to this morning we were talking about, a lot of the guys were talking about, I guess it had something to do with the subject about, you know, they were talking about periods of sobriety. Well, I got sober for a month, or I managed to white knuckle it, you know. The thought of not taking a drink or not getting high just honestly never occurred to me. It was never part of my thinking. I just didn't know any other way. And the alcohol and the drugs had become my way of living, and that's just the way it was. My wife begged me to go to Alcoholics Anonymous for the last 5 years of my drinking and drugging. She had no idea who she was marrying. When she married me, she was 26. I was 28. I got sober when I was 33. And like you said, you know, you paid for your seat. My wife paid for my seat, too. And, you know, when it came to making amends, they were some of my first amends. You know, my wife, my family, the immediate loved ones that you just, you know, you really let them down. And kind of fast forwarding, you know, because I've been talking a lot about my drunkalog, and I could talk about it for hours. I just, you know, days. You know, I think about all the shit I've done, like we all have, you know, and we can all tell the war stories. But, you know, the real deal of why we're here tonight is because what is it like today? And what it's like today is I don't have to do that shit anymore. I don't have to get up in the morning, spin one up. If I got any coke left, line it up. If I got any speed left, take that. If I got the shakes, you know, take some Valium or some downers. And then pull the Stoli out of the fridge before or the freezer on the way out the door and take a couple pulls off that. And it's 6 o'clock in the morning, you know, and I'm on my way to work, and that's how I'd start my day. And that's not normal. That's not what normal people do, you know. And I always worried about getting caught. You know, I can remember when they said they were going to start doing drug testing. I was looking for every attorney that was, you know, going to tell me that this was unconstitutional and a violation of my privacy and all that, because I knew if I can't drink or drug, I got to quit this job. I got to go somewhere, you know. But that morning I got out of jail. I called this guy that worked at the car dealership I worked at. Didn't know anything about Alcoholics Anonymous, but I knew I'd heard that this guy was an AA. And he had a couple of his cronies from AA. And we thought they were all just, what a bunch of losers, you know. And, you know, hell would have froze over before I'd have asked any of those guys for help, you know. I didn't know anything about AA, but I know I didn't want anything to do with what they had going on in those A&A rooms, you know. And so what did I find myself doing that morning after I'd come to and picked myself up off the bathroom floor and pulled my head out of the toilet? I picked up the phone and I called Ron. And I said, Ron, I think I'm in trouble and I think I need some help. And I think I need to talk to someone about this AA thing that you guys do. And I called this woman that was a friend of my wife's. She was a quart-a-day vodka drinker. She crashed and burned pretty hard. She got cleaned up, went back to school, got her law degree, and she'd made partner, and she was doing really well, and she'd been sober for 7 years. So I called Nikki, and I called Nikki and Ron, and I said, you guys come over and talk to me. So we sat there at their dining room, my dining room table, and my wife was gone, thank God. She was out of town on a job when this happened. I'm really glad she wasn't there. I don't know if I'd have made that call if she were. But I did, and, you know, Ron was asking me trick questions about, so, do you drink in bars? And I'm like, yeah. What's next? You know, I mean, they're asking me these really stupid, loopy questions about my drinking and my alcohol, and they were going to take me to this rehab that turned out to be right down the street, because Ron just happened to be personal friends with the drug and alcohol director there at API. And another trick. So they took me there, and I spent the next 30 days trying to figure out how I was going to get out of there. I spent the first 3 days on the phone plotting my escape. Little did I realize that I could have walked out at any time. I have a friend to this day that when she first saw me, I was on that payphone, you know, with the coins, and she goes, "God, you were an effing fright. You know, your hair was all, and your eyes were like this, and you were, you know, I was in charge." And then they gave me this psychiatrist. You had to have a psychiatrist while you were in there. God, I hated that guy. I hate psychiatrists. I hate counselors. I hate anyone that tells me what to do or how to do it. And this guy, Dr. D, now I get to go to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous with him. He's a member of our fellowship. And I love that guy. He's a great guy. But at the time, I wasn't so enamored, you know. So anyway, I stayed in that spin dry, and I remember walking into that first meeting down in the basement of this joint. And, you know, those first meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous that we go to, it's a very surreal experience. You just can't quite put your finger on it, you know, if you remember what it was like those first few meetings. You know, and I remember they took us by van up to La Jolla Speakers one night, and I walk in there, and we all got our bracelets on. You know, and they're all, we all, you know, you think they're looking at you. They don't care. I mean, you know. And I remember thinking, well, I don't look like an alcoholic. Well, what do I look like? You know, I mean, you know, we have this vision. I had this vision that the alcoholic was the guy in the gutter down on Skid Row drinking out of the brown paper bag, you know. And what I realized was I'm meeting stockbrokers and lawyers and plumbers and, you know, teachers, and it don't matter. You know, it doesn't discriminate, you know. And since I've been here a while, you know, I get to see young kids, 13, 14, 15, young, old. I've watched people come in with, you know, they're brand new, and they're 70 years old, and they're coming to their first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I really think it's a miracle when someone gets here when they're that old and they stay. That's really amazing to me. But so, you know, that rehab thing, did that for 30 days, and I remember going back to work and just having panic attacks. You know, I couldn't deal, you know. I didn't know how to do this life thing sober, clean. But I kept going to those meetings, and I don't know, you know, it's a God thing. Mike Maher, the medical director, said, "You'll never make it. You'll never make it." On my exit interview, he told me I'd never make it. And I thought, you son of a bitch, I'm going to show you. I'm going to stay sober for a year. But I remember I used to rub my coin and say the Serenity Prayer 60 times a day. And I went to 3 meetings a day. And I'd drive all the way up to the Freedom Ranch to go to meetings just because I could get out of my head for 2.5 hours driving up and back and then the meeting. And then I'd come home, you know. You know, I got kicked out of aftercare because I wouldn't get a sponsor and I wouldn't work the steps. It took me 2.5 to 3 years to finally work with another man and, you know, go through these steps. I don't recommend it, but that's you know, it's different for everyone. And got the first 3 down, no problem, but doing that 4th and 5th and working on amends and working on the shortcomings, making the list. The inventory thing I love step 10, I love step 11. And I love step 12. I love working with others. You know, I work with a lot of guys that are new. And I do get, I don't know what it is, man. I get some hard cases, man. I get the ones that are spun, that are really fucked up and mental, you know. And that are really kind of the helpless variety that have been in and out. And I don't know what it is. Why are they attracted to me? You know? Really. I mean, seriously, man. I got this guy I'm working with now, and he hasn't called me for a week. And I'm like, I'm kind of worried about the guy. But I kind of got to give him space because I get pretty emotionally invested in these men. And I can't save them. You know, I can't save them. And, you know, when you see it work, when you see the light come back in people's eyes, when you see the families coming back together again, when you see them working out, the jobs are going okay, and sometimes they aren't, sometimes they aren't. But the gift of seeing people get sober and stay sober is just, man, I can't say enough about it. I love AA. And I hated you people when I first got here. I mean, you want to talk about anger? I was the poster child for anger. I cannot believe the crap that came out of my mouth when I first got up in front of that room, Monday night Eastside Group and Sunday morning Battery Chargers. Wow. I could never, ever repay those people for putting up with my bullshit for the first 5, 6, 7 years. I was not a happy camper, you know, and today just life is just so great, you know, and just because you get sober and you stay sober and you do the things that we're supposed to do doesn't guarantee you a new car, doesn't guarantee you money in the bank, it doesn't guarantee you that you're going to get along with your wife, doesn't guarantee you that you're going to get along with your job. Or your wife and your employer, and everything's going to be great at the job. I've had more things happen to me in the last 10 years of my sobriety that a lot of people probably would have drank over. You know, I've experienced loss of jobs, had money, lost money, death of loved ones. I mean, real life stuff, you know, that really tears people a new one. And there is nothing that taking a drink today is going to make that any better or change the situation. I don't mean to be dramatic, but I think that when I saw that movie Leaving Las Vegas, and I saw Nick Cage in that movie portraying an alcoholic who drank himself to death, that's me. It's not about the fun and the party, and it's about getting your load on and just staying drunk. And the guilt that would consume me if I went back out and did this thing, I just want to be left alone. Isolate, leave me alone. Just let me drink. I would check out. I wouldn't do it at home. I would just go check in somewhere. And I don't want to do that. I never had one drink in my life. I think one of the greatest gifts I ever got when I got here was that for the first time in my life, I got honest. You know, the how it works, the honesty, the open-mindedness, and the willingness. Slowly the door creaked open for me. You know, I finally had to own to my innermost self who I was. Randy is an alcoholic. He's a drug addict. He's sick. He's not bad. He's just sick. He has a disease of the body and the mind and the soul and the spirit. And, you know, I was all those things. I was bankrupt in all ways. Spiritually, mentally, emotionally. I still had stuff. I still owned my house and had some money in the bank and I had a job. But all that shit was going to start going away. It was all... My wife was getting ready to go. She'd been getting ready to go for the last 3 years. And I have been married to that woman for 24 years. And that is a miracle. Because we mix it up pretty good sometimes. And she's very willful and stubborn. And man, I got a 14-year-old daughter that I share about at meetings. And if she's not one of us, I don't know. She's a mirror. She's a mirror of her father. But she hasn't picked up yet. And I hope she doesn't. I hope she doesn't have to go through what I had to go through to get here. She's a good kid, but man, and she's never had to see her dad, you know, drunk. She's never had to see her old man loaded, which I just think is a real gift. And I didn't have to drag my daughter through that. I'm really grateful I got sober when I did. And you know, the people in this room have carried me. Like Stuart said, congratulations, Stuart. 1 year is a big deal. I remember when I saw Ben A. get a 5-year chip. I thought that was a joke. I thought, no way. He's lying. No one can stay sober for 5 years. How do you stay so? How do you not take a drink for 5 years? I can't not take a drink for 5 minutes. And you're going to tell me you haven't had a drink in 5 years? I couldn't even conceive of it. And little by little, the years add up. And, you know, next February, man, I'm going to have 20 years. That is a miracle. That is a miracle. Thank you. It is all God-given. It is all God-given, you know. And getting up in the morning and reading my daily meditation and reading my 20... I still have the same 24-hour-a-day book that I did when I got out of rehab. And every day it's a new thing. And I love the stuff in there. I read that and it gives me good direction. I found this meeting about a year ago called Attitude Adjustment. It's a daily meeting at 7 o'clock in the morning. What an appropriate name for a meeting, Attitude Adjustment. I go there before I go to work and I get my attitude adjustment. And the people in that room, man, I love the people in that room. And I love the people in AA. I was just up on Whidbey Island. I got to wrap it up here. I was just up on Whidbey Island, Washington, and they got this little clubhouse up there in Langley. And I've been going up there for about 12 years. And I couldn't wait. I couldn't wait to go to the clubhouse. And I didn't have the schedule, and they don't have a 24-hour thing, so I kept driving by it. You know, when's it going to be open, you know? And finally I called, and someone called me back. I left a message, and they told me when the meeting was going to be, and I finally got to a meeting up there. But I love that little clubhouse. And I've been up there sometimes when my ass has been falling off, because my sister had moved up there, and my sister, who was 9 years younger than me, I mean, I raised that sister. I took care of her from the time my mom brought her home from the hospital. And she died of ovarian cancer 8 years ago, and she died in my home. And I took care of her and did the whole thing with hospice. And, you know, I did it with dignity. And I spoke at her funeral, and I planned her funeral. And it was beautiful. And there were 200 people there, and we did another one back home in Minneapolis. When my dad died, I was 28. I was full-blown in my disease. I got the phone call that my dad had died. He died a month after my wife and I had gotten married. I called my friend in Minneapolis. I told him to pick up an 8-ball. I told my boss I was going to be gone for a couple of weeks. I went home. I drank a fifth of gin. I got on the airplane, and I showed up loaded for bear. And I stayed medicated for the next 10 days. Sat in a boat. I fished. I don't know how I didn't fall out and drown, but, you know, I mean, that's how I handled it. That's how I handled everything. And today my solution is when I'm hurting, I go to a meeting. I call a friend. You know, to the newcomers, when they say, you know, use the phone, pick up the 500-pound telephone, just do it. Just call someone whether you know them or not. Anyway, I hope I didn't, you know, talk too long tonight. I was totally not prepared. I just spoke from the heart. I had no idea I was going to be here doing this tonight, but I love Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, the steps, working with others, working with a sponsor, going to meetings, being of service. I take commitments in AA. I work with others. I'm of service at other meetings. I probably go to 7 or 8 meetings a week. Sometimes I go to 2 a day. And I don't know. I just make time for it. And it works for me. All the other stuff gets done. And I love you guys. And thanks, Al. Oh my gosh.